Penguin Random House Audio presents The Scrum Fieldbook, a masterclass on accelerating performance, getting results, and defining the future. This is the author, J.J. Sutherland. For V-Star, for insisting the book's bedrock be joy, para exigentes nuestra estrella de poste del libro siempre ser esperanza, for declaring you married a writer, para caer en amor con me otra vez, for the constant reminder to look to the light. Estoy muy bendecido y agradecido contigo en mi vida. This book would not be what it is without you. Chapter 1. The Choice Before Us. One of the most exciting things about life to me is the frequent discovery that the way I thought the world worked isn't, in fact, the way the world works. I find the revelation of just how mistaken I am to be thrilling. It implies that there is a fresher, better, more accurate, and more encompassing way of seeing the world. I have been given the gift of realizing that my old axioms, my old locked-in ways of understanding how things work, were wrong. Usually, I find that the way things work in biology and science and business and in life is more intricate and involved, more subtle, and more open to change than I ever imagined. It's incredibly freeing. It reminds me of the story behind the publication of Antoine Lavoisier's revolutionary book, Traité élémentaire de chimie, The Elements of Chemistry, in 1789. Lavoisier proposed that through rigorous experimentation, one could derive basic principles. It is a maxim universally admitted in geometry and indeed in every branch of knowledge that, in the progress of investigation, we should proceed from known facts to what is unknown. In this manner, from a series of sensations, observations, and analyses, a successive train of ideas arises, so linked together that an attentive observer may trace back to a certain point the order and connection of the whole sum of human knowledge. Lavoisier theorized that there were basic chemical elements that could not be broken down. He argued that they formed the building blocks of matter, and so he rigorously began to seek them out. He's the scientist who named oxygen, hydrogen, and carbon, the person who discovered oxygen's role in combustion and respiration, who showed that water is made up of hydrogen and oxygen. He revolutionized the field of chemistry. He created a whole new language to describe how the component parts of reality interact with each other. In other words, he described anew how the world works. He was able to use the basic principles he set out to predict the existence of other elements that weren't discovered in his lifetime. Before Lavoisier, chemists could only examine those chemicals that nature just happened to have left lying around. Lavoisier's idea was that instead of just limiting ourselves to those elements, why not experiment until we can find the entire universe of all possible chemical compounds, not just those that we conveniently stumble upon? His ideas were stunning. The publication of his book became one of the great dividing lines in the history of science. Before Lavoisier, scientists and intellectuals assumed the world worked one way. After, it was understood that the world worked completely differently. Modern chemistry was born. The world had fundamentally shifted. Today, everything from the buttons on your shirt to the chill of your refrigerator to the ink on the pages of books or the very chips driving the device that allows you to hear these words is there only because of that discovery. I love it when that kind of thing happens, when a new discovery fundamentally changes how we view and understand the world we live in, when everything we thought we knew is thrown into question because of new information or new data, when the world was one way one day, and the next we have possibilities we weren't even capable of conceiving the day before. A new way of thinking. In the years since the publication of my first book, Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time, co-authored with my father, Jeff Sutherland, more and more people are waking up to the fact that we are in the midst of a similar change in how the world of business works now. A revolution is driving change in the business world, and, as with Lavoisier's work, it is showing us a new world where the old limits don't even apply. I've been using a new phrase recently in my conversations with companies, CEOs, and senior executives. Scrum is the art of changing the possible. The need for Scrum is being driven by rapid social, economic, and political changes, which in turn are being driven by the immense speed of technological advances. You've no doubt heard of Moore's Law, coined by Gordon Moore, the co-founder of Intel. In 1965, he wrote a paper with the joyful title, Cramming More Components onto Integrated Circuits. What is now called Moore's Law is the conclusion of the paper. The number of transistors on a chip would double every 2 years. That's exponential growth. Oh, and the price of that increased computing power is cut in half at the same time. We cannot even perceive how fast that rate of change is. It is becoming impossible to wrap your head around what will come next. Let me share an old French children's riddle to illustrate just how fast things are taking place. Let's say you come across a beautiful lily pond, maybe the one in Giverny made so famous by Monet's dozens of paintings. Picture it in your head, still water, lilies floating on the surface, maybe a small bridge, the sky and the trees framing the pond, painting it with their reflections. Now, let's say the number of lilies in the pond doubles every day. 30 days from now, they'll completely cover the surface of the water, smothering the pond with petals. The lilies, through no fault of their own, will kill all other life in the pond, fish, frogs, even the lilies themselves. But there's time, isn't there, to save the pond? And after all, the lilies are lovely. If you decide to wait to intervene until the lilies cover half the pond, how many days will you have to save the pond? One. Just one. On day 29, the lilies will cover half the pond. The next day, they will cover the whole thing. Let me offer another example of the pace a doubling of transistors and power brings about. Let's use the famous example of grains of wheat on a chessboard, which dates back to 1256, giving you some indication of how long people have been thinking about this sort of thing. If you were to place one grain of wheat on one square of a chessboard, and then, in each succeeding square, double the number of grains of wheat, by the time you got to the last square on the board, you would have doubled 63 times. That last square would have some 9 quintillion. 9 quintillion, 223 quadrillion, 372 trillion, 36 billion, 854 million, 775,000, 808, to be precise, grains of wheat. That is a big, big number. Incomprehensible, unfathomable, and that is the rate of change we are living through. The old ways of working are breaking down when faced with rapidly changing problems that are simply beyond their capacity of addressing. Complexity is no longer a rarity, is something we must grapple with every day. What happens after what comes next? Scrum is a way for a person, a team, or an organization to be able to respond to that complexity, to respond to change that cannot be predicted, to move nimbly with alacrity through a constantly changing problem space. The sheer pace of the changes we are living through demands a different way of working. Scrum is an answer to that problem. But to truly get the power of Scrum, the kind of dramatic productivity and value delivery increases it provides, there has to be a fundamental change in management and operations. While a few Scrum teams can get things out the door with remarkable speed, what you really want is Scrum at the enterprise level. The traditional structures have to change. The incentives have to change. Performance management has to change. And people across the organization, even if they aren't on Scrum teams themselves, have to learn how to interact with, supply, help, and manage those teams in a new way. People in traditional organizations, once they really grasp the size of the change necessary, sometimes just throw their hands up. It's impossible. Just too big a leap. There's too much bureaucracy, too much history, too many corporate ways of doing things in established companies. We can't just change everything, managers say. That's just not how we work around here. And if things go wrong, they start looking around for someone to blame. It doesn't matter who is responsible for a company's success or failure or how the money was spent or what went wrong. The only thing that matters is what happens after what comes next. The past is the past. This is true in business, politics, or relationships. What do you want the future to look like? How can you position yourself to take advantage of the changes you know are needed? How do you build your team, division, or company, not simply resiliency, but a system that actually helps the team grow stronger each time a problem is encountered? How do we build a system robust enough that every time a disaster strikes, it not only recovers, but grows, learns, and becomes more capable? The best organizations learn from their mistakes and successes and then systematically use those lessons to get better. As I often tell my teams when they bring me something that failed, great. Now we know that doesn't work. Next time, bring me a more interesting mistake. What you really want is what I call a renaissance enterprise, one that has freed itself from the shackles of the past, from the old ways of looking at the world, and is now capable of creating things that were unimaginable
Sample complete. Ready to continue?